Reynolds, who have not finished races well in the past, are going to do it today. Here they come another time.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Mark Rogers. I'm the host of the program.
I've been a fun fan for
years. F1Weekly.com podcast.
We're going to do tire changes maybe next year. I think we
Hi, this is Desiree. I'm your fabulous, fierce female Formula One fan.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 747, February 19th, 2018. Nasser, introduce this standalone interview podcast because it's important.
Yes, and it's 747, so I have to say greetings and jumbo regards to all the F1 Weekly familia. So this conversation is with a gentleman by the name of Nigel Roebuck. People who follow motor racing who know this journalist very well. He started covering Formula One in the early 1970s, and that's when I started following Formula One. And I have been reading and enjoying his work, and again, is one of those people with a serious depth of knowledge of motorsports, obviously coming from an era where you can just walk up to a driver a minute before the start of the race and have a quick word, and, you know, when they were friends, real friends with racing drivers. And I met him some years ago, actually, at the Indianapolis airport, and there was just a brief chat, and I had a nice chat with him in Austin, and we agreed to do an interview at Goodwood. But then I saw him at Daytona, and I said, you know, Goodwood is going to be very busy, so let's talk to him here. And I was hoping for a 20-minute chat, and that, you know, rolled into almost a 60-minute chat. So I thank him very much. This is, one doozy. Really enjoyed talking to him, and hopefully, you know, we can have more chats with him. And I hope our listeners also enjoy this conversation.
Okay, folks, I'm here with Arnige. This gentleman is champion of racing journalism. Mr. Roebuck, great to see you. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Enjoying Daytona.
I know you're a Grand Prix Formula One man. Your take on the American sports car scene these days?
Well, I mean, I've been to this race many times, but this is my first visit for 5 years to the Daytona 24 Hours, and the cars in the race now are much more sophisticated than when I was here. They were the Grand Am cars when I was here before, and they race very well. I mean, but they weren't particularly exciting cars. They didn't have that much horsepower, but the great thing about them was they didn't have a lot of downforce either, so they were, you know, they were good to watch. The cars used to slide, and when I first started going to races when I was a kid, I mean, I fell in love with the sight of cars sliding in opposite lock drifts and whatnot. And unfortunately, that's now gone in Formula One. Downforce has taken care of it. But the cars I'm seeing this year are much more sophisticated than in the past. So, I mean, the sports car racing in the States to me looks to be in pretty good shape.
Are you a big fan of the Le Mans 24-hour race also?
I used to be. I only ever went to Le Mans twice, and it was right after I left school. One of which was, I think, probably the greatest Le Mans ever. And probably in terms of, when I think of the drivers in that race, that was probably the greatest collection of drivers in one race there has ever been, ever will be. Because there were, you know, a lot of Formula One drivers, but also because Ford were involved, and they brought over people from the States, like Mario, for instance, who in those days, this was before Mario was in Formula One, but they brought over people like him, and they brought over people from NASCAR. As it was a fantastic collection of drivers. It was an amazing entry with, I can't remember how many factory Fords there were, seven or something like that, and there were four factory Ferraris and the Chaparrals and all. It was fantastic. But it was, I'm showing my age here, but I mean, and that was before the circuit had been changed. It was the original Le Mans circuit with the old S's and Mulsanne flat out with no chicanes and all the rest of it. And it was highly unsafe, but it was a fantastic spectacle.
Our listeners would like to know which particular year you're talking about and some other names, please.
Sorry, say again.
Which particular year you're talking about and some Formula One names. Oh, I remember Holman and Moody people went there also.
The year I'm talking about is 1967, and the race was won finally by Dan Gurney, the late Dan Gurney and A.J. Foyt in a Ford. But it was, I just remember that as... one of the great races I ever attended.
Now, I've been enjoying your work for many, many years. Great stories you have, and I love hearing them and reading them. One of my favorites is you driving in the late 60s near Heathrow and someone flashing his headlights behind you. Please tell our listeners about this experience.
Well, yeah, it was funny. I was on the M4 motorway near Heathrow Airport. And I can't remember why I was going to Heathrow, and I can't remember why now. Maybe I was going to pick somebody up or whatever. But I had a Lotus Elan, and I was driving along the M4, and I passed another Elan. This was an Elan Plus 2. And as I drove past, to my utter astonishment, I looked across, and Jochen Rindt was driving it. And anyway, I passed him, and within, I don't know, 15, 20 seconds, Jochen had speeded up, and he was right behind me, and then blasted past me. And then, as soon as he'd passed me, he backed off again. And I just always thought that was just interesting, in terms of Jochen's character. Another Lotus had passed him, and, momentarily couldn't stand it, and he had to repass me. So this was probably 2 years before I was actually involved in Formula One. I mean, I never knew York, and he was killed at the end of 1970, and I started at the beginning of 71.
Tell us your memories of your first Formula One Grand Prix.
Well, it was at Barcelona. In 71, it was a Montjuïc, the old wonderful old street circuit, and this had all come about because I wrote to Car and Driver magazine, essentially saying, you don't know me, but I want to cover Formula One, and can you help me? And to my amazement, the managing editor there was an English girl, actually, lived in New York for a long time, Caroline Hadley, happened to get my letter, and she wrote back and said, all right, well, if you think you're so clever, go to Barcelona and write us a report, and if we like it, we will print it, and if we print it, we will pay you. So it was on that basis that I set off to Barcelona. And the first morning, I guess it would have been the Thursday morning, I drove down there for a start in my Elan, and it still amazes me that the car made it to Barcelona because it was always braking. But I've never forgotten that first morning. I had gone to a Formula One race at Alton Park about a month or 6 weeks earlier, knowing that I was going to be going to Barcelona, and thinking, well, I don't know anybody. And I was thinking, who is there in the paddock I can approach who might help me? And I decided to talk to Rob Walker, who is, of course, famous for, apart from anything else, for being the man who owned the team that Stirling Moss drove for. And so I told him, I introduced myself, and I told him I was going to Barcelona. I'd never covered a race of any kind, and my first race was going to be a Grand Prix to cover. And he was very helpful, it was lovely. And he told me where to apply for a pass, where to pick it up, and all that sort of thing. So I walked into the paddock that first morning. It was a boiling hot morning. And I thought, well, the first thing is I need to find Rob to thank him. And I did, found him. And he just said, well, if you're going to be covering Formula One now, from now on, you better meet everybody. And he spent the next hour and a half taking me around the paddock, introducing me to all the drivers. Oh, can you imagine that? Can you? It's literally unthinkable today that that could happen. I can remember at one point, we got to Lotus, and Colin Chapman was there talking to Emerson Fittipaldi, and Rob just walked up and said, Colin, could you leave that for a moment and come and meet somebody? And Colin did. Well, you know, as I say, try and imagine that now with, I don't know, Toto, or, you know, stop talking to your driver, come and meet my friend. So, in the space of an hour and a half, 2 hours, I met all my heroes, and it was surreal. I couldn't believe it was, you know, it was happening to me. So that whole weekend was kind of a dream. It just passed in a dream, and it was. And that weekend, one of the great friendships of my life was with Chris Amon. And that was the first, of course, like all the others, that was the first day I met him. And I talked to him at some length later on in the weekend and sort of said, can we do an interview? And, of course, in those days, there was no PR at all. You just, if you wanted to interview a driver, you just went to the driver and said, can we do a tape? And then it was just a matter of saying, and quite usually, they would say, yeah, okay, you want to do it now? And you would just go off and sit on a pile of tires or something and do the interview. It was very, very different. It was like Formula One was sort of, it was almost like a family in those days, and there were genuine friendships between drivers and journalists, for instance, which as far as I'm aware don't exist now. And of course, everybody flew together. You know, hardly anybody had a private plane. So, you know, you would fly back on Sunday night or Monday from a race, and though, you know, you'd be surrounded by drivers on the plane. So that if you'd missed seeing them after the race for whatever reason, then you could catch up with them then, and you know, and talk to them then.
Now, if I remember correctly, Barcelona 71, Montjuic Park, was the first time Firestone brought slick tires in Formula One racing. Among drivers, who impressed you most and who were kind of like snobbish, if I can use that word?
I don't remember any being snobbish. Obviously, you know, it's the same with any group of people. You're going to like some people more than others. But nobody... I just remember everybody being helpful. Nobody gave me a difficult, hard time. I don't know what to say. Before I went to Barcelona, actually, I went to Silverstone one day. There was a Goodyear test, and Jackie Stewart was there. And I went up and introduced myself again. He had no idea who I was. I just said, oh, I'm going to be working for Car and Driver. And then I said, could we do an interview sometime? And that was the thing. And he did, I say, I had just introduced myself. And he said, yeah, do you want to do it now? And I had about, 45 minutes with him.
Very impressive.
Now, inconceivable now.
Oh, absolutely. Did the check ever arrive in the mail from Car and Driver?
Yeah, it did. They liked the story, and so I got paid. just as well, because I had to pay for the trip and sort of hope that I'd get some money back afterwards. So, it worked out.
Okay, now this is a very interesting question for me. You are from the land of world champions, from Hawthorne to Hamilton, but your favorite driver is French, and he's not Alain Prost. Give us your some history about your favorite driver's racing career, please.
Jean Barrault was my hero when I was a kid, and I never really understood why it happened. I mean, I remember going with my dad to Alton Park. They used to have a Formula One race every year at Alton called the Gold Cup. And Barrault was there driving a Gordini, and I can't tell you why, but I saw him in the paddock. Of course, that was the other thing, wasn't it? It was different in those days. You know, when I was so lucky, again, when I was a kid, my parents fortunately loved racing, so I started going to races with them. But of course, you know, for a pound, you could buy a pass to go into the paddock. So I grew up with that, and I just thought that was normal. But I remember seeing Barrault in the paddock by the Gordini truck with his car there, and for whatever reason, I just couldn't take my eyes off him. I was bewitched. I was 8 years old, and I was completely bewitched. And the day Barrault was killed, I always say that was the first time I was 13 years old, and that was really the first time in my life I ever had to confront grief, you know, because I had been to that was August 1959, and in April there was a Formula One race at Aintree, the Aintree 200, and we went, of course, and he won it. And it was one of the happiest days of my life. And as it turned out, of course, it was the last race he ever won.
Will you tell our listeners what happened between Monsieur Berra and Ferrari team manager Signor Tavoni, I believe it was, at that time after the French Grand Prix?
Yeah, well, of course, the French Grand Prix at Reims. And there was there in 1952 that Berra had scored his first sort of great victory. When in the Gordini he beat the Ferraris, including Ascari, and he was fiercely patriotic, and it really mattered to him in any race in France. He wanted to excel, and at the start, the guy called Toto Roche, who used to start the races in France, and he did some very strange things, Toto Roche, and quite often he would drop the flag to start the race standing in front of the cars, which is not very intelligent really. But and because of this, on this particular day, Barrault stalled, so everybody else went and he was left on the grid with a dead engine. They fired him up, and off he went, but a long way behind. And he was furious in France. He was being humiliated. So he drove absolutely flat out. I think he seems to remember he got up to second or third, but he overrevved the engine, and the engine blew up. So he comes into the pits to retire and gets out, and Tavoni starts yelling at him because he's overrevved the engine and all the rest of it. And Barrault just punched him. One punch. Down went Tavoni. And that was the end of his, that was the end of his Ferrari career. And sadly, of course, it was about a month after that he was killed in his Porsche at Arvis.
How did you get that news? There was no internet or live TV in those days.
Or that he'd been killed. Well, he was actually killed in a sports car race the day before the Grand Prix, and so on a Saturday. And I was 13 years old. I was watching TV. It was always sport Saturday afternoon. In summer it was cricket, in winter it was football, but it was always sport on Saturday afternoon. And I was just watching this. It was called Grandstand, this program. And at one point they were televising a cricket match, and they interrupted the commentary to make this announcement that French racing driver Jean Bérard has been killed at the Arvis this afternoon. It was one of the worst moments of my life. I could not believe what I was hearing. You know, it was terrible, terrible. And I was on my own too. My parents were out, so I was there on my own. I had nobody to talk to about it. So it was awful, awful day.
Now, Italy has produced two of the first three drivers to become world champions, but none since 1953, while Britain has produced 10 world champions since 1958. What do you think is missing in Italian motorsports that they cannot produce another world champion?
I really honestly can't tell you. It's something that so many of us have talked about for so many years. I mean, Italy's had a lot of, since Ascari, Italy's had a lot of very, very good drivers, like, well, Castellotti and Musso back in the 50s, but then people later on like Alboreto, really, really good drivers, but not one of them has been sort of up there. At the very top level, and there's no logical explanation for it. I can't tell you. I mean, by the same token, you know, how many great drivers has France produced? I mean, nobody near Alain Prost. So it's odd, and you think back to the late 60s. You know, three drivers from New Zealand in Formula One. Eamon, McLaren, Holm. I mean, now we have another one, actually, with Brendan Hartley. But again, how did that happen? Three drivers from New Zealand in Formula One. And then that was that. No more. Until now. There's no explanation, I'm afraid. It's just the way it works out. I can't tell you.
I'm a big fan of Italian motorsports, Monza, Ferrari.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would love to
Me
see
too.
It there. Okay, I know you have a lot of admiration for two drivers, both from North America. Before we talk about them, I would like your remembrance on three drivers on personal and professional basis: François Sivert, Ronnie Peterson, and when you already mentioned Michele Alboreto. I was a huge fan of all these drivers.
François was, well, I guess as much as anything, the first thing everybody remembers about François, I mean, he was just such a strikingly good-looking guy.
Those eyes.
Ah, Jesus, astonishing eyes. I only actually come across, you could actually get transfixed by his eyes, and the only other person I've ever met whose eyes were like that was Paul Newman. Newman's eyes, blue eyes, were absolutely piercing. So, yeah, that was, and it was the same with François. He was just a lovely, lovely guy. I mean, he was. Thing that I always admired about François as much as anything else. I mean, François absolutely revered Jackie Stewart, and I mean, he always said Stewart taught him everything, you know, he knew, and that's probably true. But interestingly, the last race Jackie ever won was at Nürburgring in 73, and François was sort of, you know, just sat behind him for the whole race. They finished 1-2, and Ken Tyrrell, I remember Ken Tyrrell telling me, this is not something I've ever said to Jackie, but I remember Ken Tyrrell saying, by that time, he said, by August 1973, François could have passed Jackie if he'd wanted to. Maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. But he had become he had become a really good driver. And of course, tragedy is he was killed at the end of 73, and he was going to be Tyrrell number one in 74. Who was next?
Ronnie Peterson and Michele Alboreto.
Ronnie Peterson was again a lovely bloke, lovely guy, stunningly quick. But the thing about Ronnie was that he was absolutely hopeless at setting up a car. I mean, literally hopeless. And he never got any better. That was the amazing thing. All the years he did Formula One, he never got any better. And that last year in 78, when he was Mario Andretti's teammate at Lotus, in the end, every race, he would just copy Mario's settings. And which didn't bother Mario at all, because, you know, as Mario always used to say, well, they're my settings, you know, they suit me. I mean, they're not Ronnie's settings, so if he wants to use my settings, that's up to him, you know. But yeah, I mean, one of the very, very quickest I ever saw. But yeah, as I say, absolutely useless as having a car. And he knew it. He knew it. And Michele, another lovely bloke. You know, I mean, so many of them, thinking about it. And he was a real purist, Michele. He was he was one of those, like Alonso is today. Here's Alonso doing this race. Well, Michele was that same thing. Michele loved to drive. He loved to race anything. He was just short of being a great driver. I mean, he had days when he was a great driver, but there have been a lot of people like that. But a very, very good driver, and just a lovely, lovely man. And saddest thing of all is that, you know, and then he dies in an Audi sports car doing a straight line test. I mean, terrible, terrible.
Do you remember his 1985 German Grand Prix victory over Prost when his Ferrari engine was smoking in the closing stages?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, that's right. There was no way it was going to finish, but it did. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yes, I do remember that.
It reminded me of Nuvolari's victory many, many years ago at Nürburgring in Alpha.
Ah, yes, same thing. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Okay, now drivers from this side of the pond, which I've always admired, Gilles Villeneuve from Montreal and Mario Andretti from Nazareth, PA.
Well, these two people, I mean, you mentioned they are... Okay. Gilles was, and Mario is, a friend. I mean, you know, Gilles' career was so short. I think about it now, I mean, less than 5 years. I mean, it was a very short career. I think I will always believe he was the fastest driver I've ever seen. And he was so unusual in the sense that he really didn't care at all about championships. Now all we talk about is the World Championship. And it really didn't matter very much to Gilles. What mattered to Gilles was winning races. And he always used to say, well, you know, if you win enough races, the championship comes along. Gilles could never drive for points. You know, he wasn't interested in that at all. As I say, I think he was the fastest driver I've seen, and he was just such a great bloke, such a great guy, and absolutely honest, completely honest. You know, if he screwed up, he was the first to say, yeah, my fault. Which they don't do these days either. That's something else that's gone. His accident, his death was terrible, terrible day. You remember the race before was at Imola when Pironi stole the victory from him. And I had that was on the Sunday, obviously. On the Tuesday after the race, after Imola, I rang him, and we were on the phone for well over an hour. And I recorded the conversation, and I still have the the recording of the conversation. And I have never ever heard a racing driver talk like that. The first thing I said was, "Have you spoken to Pironi about it?" And he said, "No, I haven't spoken to him, and I'm not going to speak to him again ever." I thought, Jesus. And that set the tone of the whole conversation. Couldn't believe. The thing was, he had trusted Pironi. He thought he was his friend, and he was completely disillusioned that that Pironi could do that to him. So, I confess, when I came off the phone that morning, I felt very apprehensive about. I just thought, Jesus. I remember he said something about. Anyway, now I know where I am with Pironi, and we go to Zolder, and I'll take the same chance with him I would with a Brabham or a Lotus. Or Williams, and it worried me. I mean, Gilles had such an absolute personality, and I have no doubt whatever that it was that led to his death.
But you know, that race at Dijon-Prenois 79 and that victory at 1981 Jarama, yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Dijon was. I think anybody who was there would say the same thing. I've never seen it didn't last that long. It was only for a few laps, but the intensity of that battle was unbelievable. And as Jabba, we won the race, but as he always says, nobody remembers that. But the great thing about it was that they, again, it's very different from now. When they got out of their cars, they embraced.
Yeah,
So, and they were great friends before that, and they remain great friends.
I remember running into René Arnoux at Le Mans some years ago, and first thing I said to him was Dijon-Prenois 79, and he goes, "Best race in the world," and he had great memories of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Another story I remember, this sums the time you read stories in life, and you just they stay with you. And this is, I want you to tell our listeners about this. On a rainy Saturday in 1982, you had just parked your car at Hockenheim Ring.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us what you saw in the air.
It was an extraordinary thing. I can't remember now, but I was late. I'm normally not late getting to a racetrack, but for some reason that morning I was. And when I arrived, the session was already going. And it was raining. Got out the car. It was raining hard. I got out the car, and I went round to the trunk of the car to get my bag or whatever out of it. And I looked to my as I opened the trunk, I looked to the left. I don't know why I looked to the left, but I did. And there was the track over there, and I just saw this red thing going, and they almost sort of said, "Did I see that? Did I really see?" And obviously I had, because there was suddenly session was stopped, and so I walked over there, and oh Christ, what a scene that was. But what were the chances? I mean, I happened to arrive at just that moment and open the trunk and then look, and there it was. Yeah, it was shocking. It was really shocking. I mean, he was probably doing 170 miles an hour when he hit the back of Cross.
I remember Nelson Piquet was one of the first drivers to get there, and he said when he got to Pironi, he was yelling in French, and when he saw Piquet, started yelling in English, "Get me out," or something like that.
Yeah, he was. By the time I got there, I think he wasn't making any sound when I got there. I think they'd probably given him a jab, to. But he was very lucky. I mean, he was lucky, very lucky, in the sense that when they got him to the hospital, I can't remember which foot it was now, but it was barely attached to his leg. I mean, it was and at the hospital they wanted to amputate it, and it was Sid Watkins who said, no, you mustn't, you know, there's any chance of saving it, we must do that. Unfortunately, they listened to him, and so Pironi recovered and walked again, and then of course drowned in the powerboat.
Talking of 1980s Grand Prix racing, at that time, what did you make of the endless love and mutual charm that was going on at Lotus between the team manager and the driver from Birmingham?
Sorry, say again. Between
the relationship between the Lotus team manager and their driver from Birmingham.
Yeah, Peter Waugh and Nigel Mansell. It was a difficult relationship. You know, Mansell's a unique character. I mean, a fantastic racer, no question about it. But the trouble with Nigel was he was always moaning, he was always complaining. You know, for one thing, there was always something wrong with him. He always had a sore ankle or a cold, or there was always something. They just did not get along. I mean, you know, Peter Waugh was very, very fond of Elio De Angelis. Like everybody was. I think when Mansell left Lotus, I think it was good for all concerned. You know, we're always delighted to see him go, and Nigel was delighted to go to Frank and get away from war. It was a difficult relationship. Yeah, sure.
You know, you mentioned Elio De Angelis. It was in your magazine, Motorsport, this lunch with Peter Waugh, and they asked him about Elio and Mansell at Lotus, and he said, yeah, on one side we had a man of class and culture, and on the other we had an uncouth Brummy.
Did he say that?
Yeah, could not. And this was many years after he retired from racing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just surprised it was on the record. I mean, I can hear Peter saying things like that, but I'm just surprised he would say things like that, knowing he was going to be, he was going to be quoted. Elio was a delightful guy. That's the class. That's the right word. I mean, he was just, he had class to throw away. I mean, trouble with Elio was, I think, coming from such a rich family, racing was just one of the good things in life to Elio, but it wasn't, you know, the reason for living. So he was a lovely driver, but he lacked that last bit of aggression that a great driver needs. He's a beautiful stylist.
Formula One under new management, what do you like so far, and what direction would you like to see the sport go in?
I don't really know what to say about the new management, because so far they haven't done anything, and I'm waiting for something to happen.
We have a new logo.
Well, exactly. You've just said it, haven't you? Yeah. At some unimaginable cost, I'm sure. We have a new logo.
And there's some legal action pending from 3M on that.
Is that right? Yeah. Well, yes, I heard that. Yes. I mean, you know, there was no need for a new logo at all. I mean, we'd had the old one for years and years, and everybody knew it and liked it and was familiar with it. But obviously they've done it. It's clear why they've done it, to draw a line under Bernie. But that's about it, isn't it? I went to a press conference in Montreal last year. It lasted about an hour. And the three of them were there, Chase Carey, Sean Bratches, and Ross, of course. And everybody respects Ross. And we all listened to Ross, and Ross had some very good things to say. But when I came out, I realized that nothing either Carey or Bratches had stuck in my mind. And it just seemed to be an hour of not much, really. It was just I felt a bit empty, apart from Ross. And I got some sympathy with them, because, of course, they know nothing whatever about racing. They're not racing people.
itself.
And
the NASCAR Monster Energy Cup Championship.
Ross wants to. We were talking about the logo just now. Really, what I want them to address is the fact that in Formula One, the product, the racing, is, I think, at the moment, terrible.
And you want to be at that legendary venue, then it's something special. If you can make it, just go to IMSA.com.
Until they change the rules so that cars can pass each other. I think, you know, Formula One's troubles are going to continue. I mean, some of the races are terribly, terribly boring. And it struck me, for instance, Abu Dhabi last year, oh, it's a terrible track. It's a sort of classic, boring, modern track. But and the Grand Prix was extraordinarily tedious. But in the morning, on Sunday morning, the Formula 2 race was a fantastic race, because those cars are far less sophisticated, and because of that they can race, they can follow each other closely, and they can race. So Ross wants to change the rules fundamentally in 2021, and he's right, and they need to change. But for instance, he wants a cheaper, simpler engine. But of course, as soon as he says that, immediately you've got Marchionne. Oh, well, we're going to quit, and Mercedes don't like it, and all the rest of it. And I say, well, let them go. I think Ferrari and Porsche and Mercedes have way too much power in Formula One, and in effect, you know, they're almost, you could almost say they are running the sport. They're very clever never to supply engines to any team that might beat them or threaten them. And financially, they're in a kind of arms war. And we've had 4 years of this hybrid engine, and Hamilton has won more than half the races. Well, I mean, that can't be right, you know. So I think down the road, Formula One has to change very fundamentally. Otherwise, I worry for its ultimate future.
Now, talking of engines, do you miss the sound of Matra V12 and Ferrari V10?
Well, doesn't everybody? Absolutely. Martin Brundle said to me the other day, you know, the two-seater, I think it's a Minardi-based car, yeah, but it has a V10. And it, you know, it goes to several races. And Martin said, you know, they're paying Paul Stoddart a lot of money to take his two-seater or whatever. And he said, you know, they must be nuts, because as soon as they fire that thing up, people remember what it used to be like.
Yeah.
And suddenly think, oh, Jesus, what have we lost? So, yeah, I mean, well, the Matra was a special case. I mean, wow. Never had any horsepower, but it sounded fantastic. But, you know, in those days, it was only one of many. I mean, the Matra was a V12, the Ferrari was a V12, then the BRM was a V12.
They even had a 16 engine.
The Westlake in Dagenham's Eagle was a V12. And on top of that, you know, I always thought the DFV sounded pretty good too. So, yeah, I mean, I personally hate everything about the hybrid engine era, and I think we should get rid of it. I mean, if you want to have a politically correct racing series, okay, well, you've got Formula E, and good luck.
That's how I feel. You know, first year of hybrid, I was at the U.S. Grand Prix in Texas on the straight during the race, and I swear, I thought you can have a tent here and sleep without being disturbed.
Yeah.
Really did.
Okay. Yeah. And the thing is, these things do matter. People like Jean Todt try and play down the importance of things like the sound, but that's why, since the beginning of time, the sound is a huge part of why people go to races.
Okay, now, take five. Who will be first, Seb or Lewis?
Well, ideally, Alonso. I think Alonso is better than either of them.
Yeah, but for him, I think one of these will get five before he gets third.
So who's going to be champion next year, this year?
Yeah, you know, but who will become the first five-time champion between the two?
Oh, I couldn't really care less, but I imagine probably Lewis.
Yeah, I think so too. Now, one more important question as a racing fan. Between Max and Ricciardo, who do you think would be major pain for Lewis as a Mercedes teammate?
I think both. After last year, it seems to me some people have been almost writing Ricciardo off, and I think that's a big, big mistake. And I mean, let's remember, you know, 2014, a Red Bull, you know, Danny destroyed Sebastian when they were Red Bull teammates.
3-0.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think Max is one of those, you know, Max is a force of nature, isn't he? He's one of those that somebody comes along in every generation, whether it's Senna or Schumacher or I think Alonso. And I think Max, you know, and that's Max. So I think anybody in the same car as Max would struggle to match, particularly in qualifying. But I think either one at Mercedes would be able to give Lewis a fight, and that's what the sport needs. I mean, we're talking about Lewis having these last 4 years won. I mean, since Fernando Alonso won a Grand Prix, Lewis has won 40 times. So you can see how statistics get completely skewed.
Yeah.
It was when Fernando won at Barcelona in 2013, it was Alonso 32, Hamilton 22. And now it's still Alonso 32, Hamilton 62. I mean, yeah, and I, to me, that's been the great tragedy of the last few years. But I do think Alonso's the best. I think he's the best driver of this century. I think he's better than Michael. And for the best driver not to be in the fight apart from that, it's terribly sad for the sport. So I'm hoping that at least with the Renault engine, he's going to be able to, he's going to be a factor.
You mentioned two great names, Senna and Schumacher. We know, everybody knows what they did on the track. Off track, did you get to know them a little bit? What was your impression on them on a personal basis?
Got to know. I knew Senna much better than Michael. My problem, I got on fine with Senna, and I only started to have problems when the rivalry with Prost really got serious. Because I mean, I knew Prost long before Ayrton arrived, and I liked Prost immensely, and I still do. I also thought he was a really, really great driver. I mean, Jackie Stewart will always tell you Prost is better than Senna. And Ayrton said to me, trouble with Ayrton was you were either for him or you were against him. If you weren't completely on his side, then as far as he was concerned, you know, you were against him, which wasn't the case. But he did one day say to me, we cannot be friends anymore, you're Prost's friend. I just thought that's really sad, you know. And as far as I know, the only guy who ever managed to remain friends with both of them was Joe Ramirez. I don't know how he did it. I really don't know how he did it. And that was it. It made me very sad. Do you remember? I always thought this was an interesting sign of Senna's mentality. Do you remember when he was driving for Tolman?
Of course.
And he, and then he ignored his contract and just signed with Lotus.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Alex Hockridge not too happy about it.
Oh no, well, if you remember, they punished him by standing. He didn't. They no race at Monza,
yeah.
But he came to the race anyway. And I had written a column to say I thought Tolman were absolutely right. Because you can't just pretend you haven't got a contract. I mean, he had a contract and he simply ignored it. Well, anyway, Ayrton came to Monza. And through the weekend, I mean, half a dozen times I saw him. And at that time, we really got on very, very well. But in Monza, he wouldn't make eye contact with me. If I looked at him, he'd just sort of look away. And I thought, Jesus. And the thing about Ayrton was he read every single word ever written about him. Piquet never read a word about him. Senna read everything. So on the Sunday night, I was at the airport, and so was he. And again, he wouldn't look at me. So I thought, oh well. So I was just sitting there having a cup of coffee, and I was reading something. I looked up, and there he was. And this time, he did look at me, and he came over and sat down. And I said, ah, yeah, well, you're speaking to me again, are you? Or he said, how could you write that? How could you write that? I thought you were my friend. And I said, it's got nothing to do with it, Ed. And I mean, this happened. You signed with Lotus. You had a contract. You have a contract with Tolman, but you signed with Lotus. And I think you did the wrong thing. And I'm paid to write my opinions of things. But he took it as, well, a friend would not have written that. So I said, well, I wouldn't be a very good journalist, would I, if I said, no, I can't write anything negative about him because he's my friend. I mean, I just said, yes, and that's my job. And he kind of grudgingly accepted it and shook hands. And then we were fine again. As I say, until the rivalry with Prost really got intense, and then it got difficult. I liked him.
Yeah, I won't get into detail, but I'm sure you know how his friendship ended with this gentleman, they call him Scoop, Mike Dutson.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember now. What was that? I do remember it ending, but I thought, what was that all about?
I think when he had made some reference to seeing a thought of God or Jesus during a race, and Michael Dutson questioned him on that.
Yeah, that's right. I can't, I really can't remember the detail. It's sort of starting to come back to me now, but yeah.
Some thoughts, personal thoughts on knowing Michael Schumacher off the track?
Well, I think to a great degree, I mean, I think there were one or two journalists who were really close to Michael. Michael Schmidt of who is also German. But fundamentally, Michael's relationship with the press was quite distant. It was very difficult to get close to Michael. And again, I mean, I he was angry with me once, like Senna, in that although they were both absolutely great drivers, I really didn't like a lot of the things they did on the track. And I used to write that, and I can't remember where it was particularly. Was it the Nürburgring, Nürben, at the start? And he even put a move on his own brother, and I sort of thought, Jesus,
I remember that.
You remember that? Yeah. And I wrote something about it, and he got very. He was angry about that. And I said, all I said to him as I said to Ayrton, the things you do, you guys, now, you know, 20 years ago would have been completely unacceptable. And now, somehow, we've accepted it's quite all right to swerve across in front of somebody and put them off the road and all the rest of it. So, that's why in the end, I don't put either of those two. I've got a kind of level, a Jim Clark, Sterling Moss, Fangio level, and sort of absolutely up there. And for that reason, I don't put Senna and Schumacher with them. Although, you know, as drivers, they were both fantastic.
You have so many stories, so much experience, so much to share. I just hope this was part one with Mr. Nigel Roberts.
Well, thank you, I've enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Finally, we have listeners all over the world, quite a few in UK, and as I told you, in Austin, I'm coming to Goodwood Festival.
Oh, yeah.
Hopefully, I will be there festival speech, so I'll say hello to you.
I'll be there.
If you have time for curry and some chicken, okay. You're invited.
Okay, absolutely.
How about a message for our listeners, please?
Tell me what sort of message you'd like me to give.
Two things. First, Lando Norris yesterday asked me the same thing, so I said, well, you can say F1 Weekly is the best podcast, and anything else.
F1 Weekly is the best podcast.
Thank you so much.
Lando is completely right.
Anything else you want to say?
No, just, you know, keep faith with Formula One, and let's all hope it improves a lot in the next few years, because it needs to.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're very well.
Nigel, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Nasser, keep up the good work. The check's in the mail. I want to thank everybody who listens. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.